This is a talk about a similar thing, or basically the same stuff. This title, I hate to change titles when I hate the talk, so this is when I change the talk, but this will be only a small part of it. I added some more introduction about, more concrete introduction about what the problem is about, what is quantum or probably not in photosynthesis, and I will really try to put it on some more theoretical ground, including some equations and so on. You will see. So I start with describing photosynthetic light harvesting. And let's start really with biology. So we have this genetic tree of life, and these are all the groups of organisms that do light harvesting. There are many bacteria, and there is one part of the eukarya, with plants and algae, which also do the same stuff. So you might think this is sort of unrelated, probably evolutionarily evolved separately, but actually not. This is a result of some sort of a symbiotic event in the past when some of these small bacteria basically entered eukaryotic cells. Chloroplasts in the plants still keep partially their own DNA, so they are a result of symbiotic events. So it all actually comes from the same evolutionary direction, and some features, some real features of those small systems like reaction center, they are preserved in all the organisms. These things look almost exactly the same in all organisms. The best tutorial, best organism to start with are these photosynthetic purple bacteria, because their photosynthesis is extremely simple. Photosynthesis is always a process on membranes. So these guys create some invaginations on their cellular wall. They create two different separated water environments here, and then everything happens in this small factory here, which is called reaction center. Reaction center essentially uses the energy of photons it gets from the antenna around, or which it captures itself, to perform a one-directional electron transfer from one of these, or one side of itself, to the other side, where that thing is coupled to a proton transfer in the other direction. And that thing creates a pH, which is a concentration of protons gradient between these two environments, and that electrochemical potential drives ATP synthesis. So ATP is not association of tennis professionals or anything like that, or automatic theorem proof or whatever, but that's adenosine triphosphate, the actual molecule that stores energy. Or this is not really for storage, this is like gasoline for biology. You put it into a biological motor, it starts to move. It's like if you put the gasoline into a car and it starts and goes somewhere by itself. So the centerpiece, as I said, of everything is the electron transfer of the reaction center. And I think that who knows how this works and is not fascinated by that, well, there's something wrong with them, basically. That's what I think. So there's this mysterious excitation energy transfer first to the reaction center. We will talk about that later. Then there is energy transfer within the reaction center. These guys here, these are chlorophylls and fluorophyllins, to transfer to something called special pair. These are two chlorophylls very close to each other, and they have, it's all chemistry from now, they have the property that when they are excited as a pair, they like to lose electrons to their neighbors. So there is an electron transfer happening across their neighbors, across some neighboring bacteriophil, and then fluorophyllin is basically just a bacteriophil with one atom missing. This happens within a couple of femtoseconds. Then there is, on a longer time, an electron transfer to a molecule called quinone here. This quinone likes to take protons from the water environment here. Under normal pH, there are always some protons in the in that environment. So it picks the proton, becomes neutral again. It waits for a next step of this. Another electron comes here. There is a second proton picked up here. The electron that's missing here is actually filled from this so-called cytochrome. And then miracle happens here when this molecule gets two protons and two electrons. It's released from this protein environment and travels up here to the periplasm, where it meets the cytochrome again, there it releases its electrons, and two protons are left in the periplasm. So the result of absorption of two photons results in a transport of two protons from one side of the membrane to the other. That thing then is used to drive all the chemistry and so on. That's already not so important. The important thing here is that this happens with essentially quantum yield of one. That is, I put in one photon and I get one proton here. This, however, doesn't mean that the total energy of that proton is conserved. It's not at all. At every step, you lose lots of energy. So the energy that you get in here is only a small portion of the energy of the photon. And when it comes to efficiency of photosynthesis, as really storing into the sugars or into, I don't know, whatever you can imagine, the body of the plant and so on, this goes as low as several percent. So there is, except of the fact that the quantum yield of it is very high, there is not really anything very optimal in this place. Where the energy comes from? So this here is the reaction center. So if reaction center was the only thing that the plants or the bacteria have, then these reaction centers would mostly do nothing because light is essentially it's not a very dense source of energy. So for that, if you want to increase cross-section, you put all these other chlorophylls around, which in bacteria, now we are looking at the membrane from a top view, which in bacteria are organized in these fascinating symmetric systems, so-called light harvesting antenna 2 and 1 and so on. All these blue and green things, those are chlorophylls. You see time scales, how fast it happens, this energy transfer. At the end, everything goes to the reaction center, and you see here between this part, this last antenna, and the reaction center, there is a bottleneck of it. There is a very slow, the hopping rate here, or the lifetime of the excitation on LH1 is about 35 picoseconds. Why is that? That's because here there is electron transfer proceeding, and you don't want that electron transfer happening around here. You don't want to damage the stuff, so you put it as far as possible, essentially, but still to such a distance that the energy transfer proceeds. The energy transfer here is downhill. I have to stress that there is no doubt about where the energy goes, and that this is not a problem to find a unidirectional, to explain the unidirectional energy transfer here. It's simply thermodynamically downhill in energy. There is no problem with that. Some people suggested that there is, I don't know. So now, what happens in these antenna? The usual theory that we use is the theory of electronic excitons. So let's have neutral molecules. They are neutral but polarizable. So you can draw their energy structure like this. Each of them is in their ground state or excited state, can be excited by light, and at the beginning it's all in the ground state. Then when you excite one of them, what happens? You polarize this one, and this can polarize the other guy, and there can be energy transfer from one to another. So because they are coupled like this, these excited states are coupled like this, these states that we see here are not the eigenstates of the system. So we can start with looking first at them as collective states. So I have common ground state, both guys are in the ground state. Then I have two excited states, one or the other is excited, and I have a two exciton when I have two exciton states when I have both of them excited. These two states couple, as we said, so if we go into eigenstates, we get something like this. And here we have linear combinations of these things, energy splitting, and so on. That's all fine. Somewhere in literature, this effect, the fact that these states are delocalized, is called quantum coherence. I will come to that later, to kind of where this belongs. And when it comes to this quantum coherence, there's absolutely no doubt for, I don't know how many, since basically the structures are known 20 years. Yes, those are singlet states. All the states that I'm talking about here are singlet states. This is a molecule. So this is an electronic excitation. I excite one electron, I get a singlet excited state. Of course, there are triplets there. Triplets, for example, well, I didn't want to venture in this, but of course there are triplets here and they have lower energy than the singlets. So the interconversion can happen, and it's taking place on some lights, on some time scale. You want to prevent that basically, but not staying, by not staying excited too long. Now, these collective states that I've been talking about are called usually excitons, and basically without them, nothing would essentially happen in those antennae, at least not that fast. So now, what people observe when they attack these things with lasers, with short laser pulses, they of course expect, or they expected always, that when they excite the stuff, they create a linear combination of some states here, a wave packet. But of course, for a long time, there were no techniques where you could actually observe the effects of these coherences here, well, being there and being preserved, or if they were preserved, or how long they were preserved. It's clear that when you attack something like that with a laser pulse, you initially have that coherence there. Just people thought it's dying very fast, or they had no opinion. I had no opinion before, because basically there was no way how to look at that. Now, because you know that you can't observe it, then, well, you do test theory that is simple. That is, you use so-called secular approximation in all these relaxation theories, which essentially decouples the dynamics of the populations of your states from the dynamics of the coherences. But there was this paper in 2007 where apparently, well, first one could see the effect of these things. They lived for a long time, around 1 picosecond, let's say, and they seem to have an effect. When you had energy transfer, this downhill energy transfer, some, at least some part of this coherence has been actually taken with it. So the density matrix was not instantaneously diagonal here. This is what happens here. All right, so this is where we sort of stand with this initial description of it. You should remember that those coherences are induced by laser, that's one thing. Otherwise, light harvesting happens like this. There are antenna, there is reaction center and chemistry here. There are photoprotection mechanisms working in the antenna if it is overexposed, and everything is actually driven by sun. There's no laser here, but sun. And when it comes to sun, the changes that you see in the illumination out there, they are on really, really long time scale when it comes to comparing with the speed with which, with the rate with which the energy goes through the through these antenna. So you always, under that steady illumination, you get the system into a steady state, non-equilibrium steady state, at least when you look at the thing from the statistical point of view. Now, what happens on a single molecular level? That's what actually matters. And that matters to all this debate whether these dynamical coherences have any role or not. So that we can only answer if we go and look on something that is single molecule, a real quantum mechanics, no doubt about whether we are talking about ensemble or not. So how is it? Photosynthesis in laboratory or in nature is an ensemble problem, of course. You have lots of molecules. Even in that cavity, in that cuvette with your environment and lots of molecules that you extracted from leaves or bacteria, you have an ensemble. So what you measure are some ensemble and quantum mechanical averages. Of course, your molecule interacts with environment, not just the proteins, but water and everything. So you have to use the reduced density matrix approach and open quantum system theory. No problem. Reduced density matrix describes both statistical and quantum mechanical averages, so it's just perfect for your description. But, well, you have equations of motion that you can understand at some generalized rate equations for coherences and populations of the states and everything. But now, how shall I understand these rate equations? I have a the quantum to classical transition here. So somehow that's a point where many people, maybe everybody, gets confused. And I want to now address this problem. How shall I understand these rate equations, this statistical description? How can I make it not a statistical description? So, classical case of rate equations. I have n particles, let's say, in a box, and they are leaving the box. So I want to describe that with some kinetic equation with a rate constant k. If I define the probability of finding a random particle in a box like this, I can get an equation of motion sort of for the probability, and that thing is continuous. It's changing continuously, no problem. If I go down to a single problem, single particle in a box, and I keep this definition, then I of course have a jump in here. No problem, I can make a statistical experiment, or I can even make it in my head a thought experiment. I'll make it as a statistics. I define the probability like this, and then I can again derive equations that are where the probability changes continuously, yet the individual processes happen with the jump. And now the question of course is this happening there? Do I have these jumps? Well, I have to actually point out why do I need these jumps? Actually, I need these jumps to save this coherence problem, because if there were no jumps, there would be also no coherences, as I will show later. But nowadays people believe that despite the fact that we describe this with these quantum mechanical equations, what actually happens in the molecules is that they jump to a certain state, which is not an eigenstate of the system, so that there is, of course, lots of coherences there, and these coherences somehow get utilized. So I want to fight this notion that this is true. If I start with quantum mechanics, I describe this problem of n equal 1 with wave function. I see here that, of course, this is quantum mechanics, the probability changes continuously. Unless I measure in between, the evolution of the wave function is deterministic. So this system changes these coefficients continuously, deterministically. I measure, I find a value, whatever, but this thing is never jumping anywhere. It's not jumping even if I add environment. If I add environment and I am kind of far away from this and I don't entangle with that, here the pictures fail me, so I have to write some equation. I still have probability changing according to these coefficients here, but the coherence, the reduced coherence when I average over the bath, that is determined by the overlap of the state of the bath when I'm in and out of the box. So, from the point of view of quantum mechanics, this is still a linear combination. I just have to reduce that. That's why I'm losing the coherence. But the probability changes continuously no matter how small that coherence is. So I make my system classical from some point of view, but there is no, there is no need, I don't see where jumps would come here, unless I of course come and measure. These things, when I look at them like this, they still evolve perfectly continuously and nothing makes them jump. So I go back to my photosynthesis problem. Yeah, okay. I actually don't need them, but people who believe that coherence is important, they need them, because they believe that, let's say, I have FMO excited in a fashion where the excitation comes, jumps on FMO, so at some particular time, it appears at some state which is not an eigenstate. And then I have, of course, coherences, and these coherences can help me, maybe not, maybe yes, that can help me to transfer faster. So, I probably made some moves that I didn't want to. So how can I go beyond statistics in this coherence debate? Well, I just pick one molecule. I mean, nowadays you can even make these experiments with single molecules, but I pick one molecule. The environment, the immediate environment, I can include the same way as I did before, and now I'm just not multiplying this by n or summing over all the representations of this in my sample. I just stick with this one molecule and everything else goes into my environment. This I can do because these things in that cuvette don't really interact. There's lots of solution and so on. I can make sure that they don't interact. And then this is a description of a single molecule and nothing else. Well, and the bath and the light. So what happens? This probably doesn't have to be actually repeated in this in here, but I can have the following situation. If I want to keep the whole description in wave function description, so I can start with an initial state like this. My system is in the ground state. It's very far up in energy to the excited state, so it is essentially unentangled with the bath. There is just one state, so you can't entangle anything, and there is light here. light is switched off at the beginning, then I, well, when I will switch it off, it will make these transitions between the ground and excited states, but bath is not able to do that. That's actually the reason why there is this quantum yield of one, because the bath is only able to de-excite chlorophyll within a couple of nanoseconds, whereas all the processes of energy transfer happen on picoseconds. So if you compare there is an order of magnitude difference. I start with the Hamiltonian, where I have ground state and these excited states, no problem. And now let me imagine I do this thing that I do with lasers, that is, I switch on the light for a very short time, and then I switch it off again. So from my initial state, I get to a state which is a linear combination of the ground state and the excited state. My bath does not change at the beginning because there is a thing called Condon approximation. Of course, it's an approximation, but very well fulfilled here. This basically means that the bath does not know at first about the excitation. Your transition dipole moment does not depend on the bath coordinates. So you excite the stuff like this, and now because I don't have a channel back, this evolves perfectly separately. I can cross this term, get rid of it. The light is now in vacuum, and it also is not going to entangle with the different states here. So I cross this also, and I'm left with this part of the wave function which evolves separately. After a while, bath gets entangled separately with the with the electronic states, and then when I make a reduced density matrix and look at the coherence element, I see that it is actually controlled by the bath. This is how entanglement is involved in photosynthesis, essentially through the environment. There were many, many attempts recently to put entanglement into FMO, to divide FMO into two parts. I'm not really sure what they meant by that, because we are working with single exciton states, like with single photon, splitting cavity into two parts and talking about entanglement of a one photon with what I'm not sure between two parts and so on. It doesn't make that much sense to me. Maybe somebody will explain to me how that works, what's the meaning of it. So now, is then the, with all this stuff, is the coherence, is it then relevant, that picture that I had there with this very fast switching on and switching off the light? What happens in nature is that we have a very big light source out there, lots of radiation which is thermalized, and then we have our system and bath. So if you want to treat that, here you are, lots of terms in your Hamiltonian. Some of them you can forget because you have hardly an interaction of your chlorophyll with sun directly. You have a term that you can actually pick as a perturbation term, because you, let's say, well, I'm talking about bacteria, they live in a salt lake 10 centimeters underground in a microbial mat and so on. So this is a very small illumination, very small term. And otherwise, I have two standard system bath problems. That is my small system and the bath, and the light and the right source. Okay. Now this is kind of too detailed, but I have my equilibrium density matrix of the light. I want that to represent by a wave function. How do I do that? Well, I assume that this thing can be represented by a state vector where your photons are perfectly entangled with the state of the source. The only reason why I need the source is that I want to describe light by wave function, and it still needs to be thermalized. So then you have some conditions or what these things have to be, and you can write a Schrödinger equation with a source term. That's of course only when you say I'm projecting on the excited state. I don't care about what's happening in the ground state or how much excitation is what part of my system is in there. Then I have this interaction term. I can write it like this, quantum mechanically, and calculate what will be the state of my system when I start at T0, what will be the state at time T. And then I make, of course, nothing else I can do than a density matrix out of it, and I find that density matrix it has two parts. One part is a light correlation function, two-point correlation function, something that I can measure somewhere. And then I have this part, which is very familiar to me because I work in nonlinear spectroscopy, and these super operators here of the second order and so on, that's all what you use to describe those experiments. So this is where those ultrafast experiments come into place. They provide this, they provide the information on the time evolution. Sometimes when you want to calculate, if you want to solve an inhomogeneous differential equation, you just put a delta function on the right-hand side and solve this delta problem, which is like exciting it with an ultra-fast laser, then you get the propagator, and your solution is an integral with this inhomogeneous term. So that's actually what is here. From nonlinear spectroscopy, you get the information about the evolution of your system. That's it. So nonlinear spectroscopy is universally important, no matter whether there are coherences or not. The fact that it observes them means something for this term here, but nothing beyond that, as far as I can tell. So then when you make some assumptions about how this incoherent light should look like, you see that actually it contains some autocorrelation function of the source. You can calculate in a very simple case, for example, what type of coherences you can excite. And you find that if you go for long time, the steady illumination and so on, you find some sort of a steady state coherence there, which, well, is not zero, but believe me, is extremely small, almost nothing. And even if it would be something, it can be understood as a renormalization of the preferred basis with which I should work or something. What do you mean? Some states, two excitonic states, that is delocalized states, eigenstates of the system. That's an important question, actually. Well, of course, we found something here, made sure that we do all quantum stuff, but there was a paper from the program chairman of this conference in, 20 years ago, where he shows, and that's exactly the case here, if I had no dephasing, that result that I was showing goes exactly to delta here. There is no way you can excite coherences by thermal light. Not those dynamical coherences, that's what I wanted to say. Now, this I can skip, because it's essentially about what tools we use to calculate the stuff. But let me see. Let me talk about the following. When those excitonic systems, these core sources, are interacting with the environment, you have a certain difficulty to actually find your eigenstates in that problem. If there was no protein, you would easily find that these eigenstates are those delocalized states. That's the case where your bath is actually much weaker than the interaction between the chlorophylls, and then you would have lots of delocalization in your system. Whereas there are cases where the proteins are very strong with respect to the interaction between the chlorophylls, and then there is no delocalization. So we have these two limiting cases that actually appear in some photosynthetic systems where we have to decide. Well, if we had methods, and nowadays we seem to already have some methods which would automatically, during the evolution of that system, end up with this preferred basis at the end, everything would be solved. But we are normally at the situation that we have these two ways of looking at it, either at individual chlorophylls or the localized states that we have to take into account. Now, this coherence that we have there, the coherence in the understood as a non-off-diagonal element of the density matrix, that coherence is really, it depends on in which basis you are looking at that. There is this term, delocalization, for which many people use this term quantum coherence, which has certain meaning because space is simply important for transfer problem. So you have a transfer problem, therefore you look at the stuff at the local basis and you see some coherence. Because when you have this basis that was selected by the bath in which your density matrix become diagonal, when you transport it back to the local basis, of course you have lots of coherence, but that's all steady. That's what is called quantum coherence, and at the same time people call quantum coherence the beatings. And then sometimes when somebody clever asks, is quantum coherence important in photosynthetic systems, and they will say, of course it is, because one of them means beating and the other means this stuff. And this type of coherence is extremely important, and people know it, or they presumed since World War II, Davidoff and all these people, Davidoff excitons and so on, and they became really sure when the structures of these things became known in 90s, and that's it basically. From 90s we know that this is present there. So what, however, so basically these type of coherences, that is important, this is in the eye of the beholder. However, there is also this transient excitonic coherence, this beating stuff, which is there because you excite the thing very quickly. So if you assume that you have this type of a very simple light-matter interaction Hamiltonian, and you have a delta pulse and so on, all chlorophylls are the same, so they are excited the same, you can look at this as a problem of basically transferring your ground state into the excited state by two operations of evolution of the transition dipole moment operator, and both in local and excitonic basis you produce lots of coherence. Then this stuff decays on a picosecond time scale. The beating that is there decays on picosecond time scale. So we can have a look at the stuff in both of these possible points of view without relaxation. So if I excite my system and I look at it from the point of view of the eigenstates, nothing happens to the eigenstates, there's lots of oscillations. If I look on the sides, I see lots of oscillations of both coherences between them and the populations. If I add relaxation, and now I added relaxation that presumes that this delocalized basis is the one, is the preferred one, then I get rid of it after, well, in this case, half a picosecond, I have energy transfer between the sites. If I convert that into the local basis, I see that my coherences are steady at the end. That is, currents between the sites are steady. There is a delocalization, also sometimes called quantum coherence. So, but the beating depends very crucially on the initial condition, and that's where that's the point of it, I would say, because when you say I excite at the initially just one site of that FMO complex or whatever complex, and that site is strongly coupled to the rest, then of course it's going to be the stuff is going to be transferred to other places. This is the case of this is the site basis. So I start with site one excited, nothing else is excited, and you see I produce lots of coherence. But well, if I look at the eigenstate picture, this excitation of one state means a certain excitation of different eigenstates and lots of coherence. But what about if I don't have this? If I don't have jumps, that's what I was trying to show before. What about if I have a rate? So I have one place to which through a rate of, let's say, well, the lifetime would be 2 picoseconds, and I'm feeding this into the system. Then everything starts from zero. It oscillates a bit, but compare this oscillation and this, there's basically nothing happening in here. And also compare the scale. This is much, much smaller. If I look at the same stuff from the point of view of the eigenstates, again, nothing happens, almost nothing happens here. These coherences are big like that. Look how small they are here. Yeah? So this is 0.4, and this is not even 0.02. Yeah? So it really depends on how I excite. And I try to convince you that this picture, not this picture, is the right one. And there is no relaxation here, and coherences are already gone. Yes? They are coherent. They are coherent source in that sense that I am exciting one site, which, looking from the site from the excitonic point of view, is a coherent state. Yeah, exactly. This actually not. I mean, it's true that when you calculate how this really happens, what happens is that you excite not one site, but you don't excite an eigenstate. So, people, I heard that last week on a conference, a talk where people were basically making this point. You are transferring into a state that is not an eigenstate of your system. So when you look at the eigenstate representation of it, it will have some coherences. But I'm saying it doesn't matter because they will wash away anyway. You know, you have lots of these things with different phases actually added together. And obviously, beating doesn't help it. Refutation doesn't help it. So you have this picture, and here the coherences are basically invisible. Nothing happens. Everything is perfectly smoothed out. So I heard that in this field that you are all in, you have to have a measure to be named after you, of course. I couldn't name it myself, but you can name it to be of importance. So I devised a measure which is called amount of coherence, which essentially is this number. It starts with this number, and you know that for a density matrix to represent linear combination of states, a pure state, this has to be 1. So this measures the coherence of a pair of the states, and this here actually is a global measure which varies between 1 and 0 depending on how much your state is a pure state. And if you look then at our case of no relaxation and our 2 picosecond lifetime, you see that it goes, this type of amount of coherence goes to 0 after 500 picoseconds. If I add relaxation, it goes down on the time scale of this relaxation. Now, when I vary the rate from those 2 picoseconds, if I go to the lifetime of half picosecond, I still am somewhere down here. There's almost no coherence here, and this is without relaxation. Only when I have a rate of 20 picoseconds, which is almost the same as if I would be exciting by those very fast laser pulses, I get to something like 70% of coherence. And that's, I think, the whole story. If you look closely on our stuff, you see that the coherences cannot be created in that setting that is in the nature. So, I mean, those dynamical coherences. Otherwise, this other thing called quantum coherence is actually what's making the stuff working, I mean, those antenna. So, at the beginning, I think I showed that reduced density matrix describes a single, or can describe a single molecule in mixed state. No dynamical coherences can be excited by thermal light. So that's sort of one killer for the effect. The other killer is that you cannot really excite those coherences anywhere in your system unless you have something very fast. Well, so that leads me to a conclusion that in photosynthesis, the dynamical part of the coherence, these beatings, have no role at all, but they can be used, and many people showed experimentally how to do that already. They can be used as a diagnostic tool. Think of, let's say, a heartbeat. You can ask a question, why is there a heartbeat? Was it, I mean, the sound of it, did it evolve for something? And of course, I tell you, no, it didn't. We have a heart. The purpose of heart is to fall in love, so it couldn't actually evolve for making a sound. So the sound can be, however, used by a doctor to, you know, to listen to your heart and tell you if something is wrong with it. So it's a diagnostic tool. And with that, I want to acknowledge my old friend Leonas Varkunas, with whom I discussed this. Some parts of the work was done by my student Jan Oršina. Money came from some Czech agencies. And I'm also looking for people to join me in this beautiful city to work on photosynthesis and theoretical biophysics, lots of stuff we can do starting at fall 2012. And with that, I thank you for your attention.